Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is Mind Rolling. Raghu, I'm back with old friends. And you go, oh my God, the passing of time. Tsultram, Lama Tsultram Alioni. Welcome. Great to, we were just saying we haven't even talked since Ram Dass left, right?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Actually, and I would have wanted to get from you just a little bit about, I don't remember hearing your story of initially meeting Ram Dass or any kind of moments with him that I'm wondering, because I don't remember us ever talking about it.
I don't know if you know this, but I met Ram Dass at the same time Bhagavan Dass did.
Okay, click. Yeah, all of a sudden that's good. Yes, thank you.
1967.
Oh my.
And so Michael Riggs, Bhagavan Dass, and I were living together, sharing a house with a Japanese guy who was my boyfriend at the time. And Ram Dass came to town with David Padua. I think they had driven overland, or maybe they had gotten a vehicle in Delhi or something, but they had a vehicle.
Yeah.
And they were staying at the Salty Hotel in Kathmandu. And I didn't have a lot of connection with Ram Dass at that time, but Michael Riggs did. Bhagavan Dass did, and that's where they met. And from there, they went on the Be Here Now journey.
Mm.
But I do remember Bhagavan Dass coming back with these, you know, those tikka things in your forehead that you can stick on.
Yeah.
somehow Richard, who he was at that time, had a bunch of those. And so Bhagavan Das came back from the Sultan Hotel with those and talking about Richard. And
in a nice way?
Or? In a nice way, yeah. But, you know, sort of like, maybe not exactly romantic, but, you know, sort of impressed, I guess you could say. And then they left. And the next time I saw Ram Dass was in Bodh Gaya. I think I met you. I know I met Danny and Krishna Das and Suya and everybody else. Yep. And you were all there doing Goenka courses.
Yeah.
And I was living on the roof of the Gandhi Ashram. And I was a nun by then. So when I met in 1967, when I met Ram Dass, I wasn't a nun yet. And so I was ordained in January of 1970. And I think that was that the winter of 71, 72?
The first group was the winter of 70, 71.
Okay.
And
yeah.
That's, so that's and then I saw you after that at another time. Mm-hmm. And you were known as Anila.
Yeah. Yeah. It was nice connection with everybody then. And I was in a very visionary state. It was a visionary time of my life. And by that, I mean, I was having a lot of visions and experiences. Like I'd look at the Bodhi tree and it would turn gold, all the leaves turn gold, and a lot of bliss, ecstasy. In my subtle body. And so it was quite an extraordinary time for me. And some of you used to come visit me on the roof in that little room. I had, you know, sometimes in India, there's like one room on the roof.
Yeah. Chokiador room.
The big roof. So that's some used to come and sit with me there. And otherwise we would meet in tea shops or the Tibetan Momo tent. So yeah, that's the next time I saw Ram Dass. But I really didn't get to know him until I started traveling with him with Allen Ginsberg. And we traveled together quite extensively.
Really? I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, in the West. We went Montana, New Mexico, Colorado. We did a tour. And I did it twice with Alan, and one time Ram Dass was there. And that was quite funny, actually, to see them together.
Yeah.
Because they're both Jewish, right? And they just kind of went into this, like, kind of like two rabbis or something. And they would be like, you know, Ram, and it's Alan. And, you know, they really liked each other. And yeah, it was great. It was a great connection between them and with me also. And so we went around. What we were doing was raising funds for Trungpa Rinpoche's center, which was then called Rocky Mountain Dharma Center and then became Shambhala Mountain Center.
Right. And beyond that, from time to time?
With Ram Dass?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, then I met him in Berkeley when you all, you know, I'm not sure who was there, so.
Yeah.
But had a house. Like
yeah, we had that house. Yeah.
And I also went up to the farm in Canada. Was it Canada or Northern Vermont?
Yes, that's where you came to my dad's farm in Abercorn, Quebec, right near Tail of the Tiger. We used to go up to Tail of the Tiger from Trumpo's place there.
Yeah, and you had little stamps with Maharaji's head. And I remember we made kheer and would do, I think, Hanuman Chalisa.
Yep.
Maybe. Yep. And then eat the kheer as prasad.
Yeah.
I can't remember if Maharaji had already left his body at that time.
You know, I was thinking about it myself, and I think because we did go down there before he left his body, because it was we were back by the end of 72. So 73, I think we went down and we would go with Ram Dass. And I mean, I know we bumped into each other at different places along this path.
Yeah,
but
yeah. And then Ram Dass, you know, when he was at Naropa, we had some contact. And and then I was in New York. I came and when you all were enthralled with, what's her name?
Joya.
Joya. I came there. Uh-huh. I had darshan with her. And Ram Dass was there. And then ultimately, he helped me with Taramandala. He came and did a benefit at Taramandala after his stroke. We saw each other more in between there, you know, at Omega when we were teaching there and various other times. But I was really touched by him coming, you know, in a wheelchair to Taramandala, and we only had a tent. And he came and helped me raise money for our buildings.
Yeah. Taramandala being Lama's center in Colorado.
Yeah. Taramandala is a 700-acre retreat center in southwest Colorado near Pagosa Springs. And it started out as really 700 raw acres of really amazing, beautiful rolling hills. And we lived in tents and teepees for 10 years there. before we had buildings. And so Ram Dass came right around and we were raising money for the first building. And I stayed at my house. At that time, there were two women taking care of him.
Yeah, Marlene and Joanne, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then I went to see him a couple of times in Maui.
Yeah. What, I'm sorry, everybody out there listening, because I have talked to various friends of Ram Dass and mine since he's left, just about their impressions. And this is just one more additional family member, basically, that this is coming up in this moment. This is just, I hadn't even thought about it. And well, Ram Dass is a year past, you know, just a month or so ago. And and we've been doing many different things to celebrate his life and who he is. And did you walk away with anything, you know, just thinking back on, I mean, if somebody said to me, what's the most impressive thing that happened in your relationship with Ram Dass? And it was, and I say this a billion times, it was trust. I never trusted anyone in the instant that I met him, that everything that he was, that was moving through him, I was 100%. And that was a huge thing for me. So that was one thing. What, anything that you could say in a system?
That's an interesting question. I think the most impactful time I had with him was in Maui after my husband David died. When David died, that was 2010, and he was my partner on every level, including creating this big project in Colorado and emotionally and spiritually. So it was a big loss, and it was very sudden, overnight. He was 54 years old. Mm. And so it was, I think, 2016, I went to Maui and to see him, because I think it was you that said, you should go now. Like, there's not a lot of time left. Mm. I don't think. And, or maybe it was Krishnadas that said that to me. And so I went just to see him. And we sat down to a breakfast at 8 in the morning. And we were still there at the table at 2 p.m. Uh-huh. And they said they'd never seen him do that, you know, like for that long. But it was a really, I think one of the things that Ram Dass enjoyed about me was that I came from a different tradition. And so he could present his view of something, and then I could say, yeah, well, from the Buddhist point of view or the Tibetan point of view, it's this. And so he was kind of interested in a learning way, you know, to hear from another tradition. But that wasn't the main impactful thing for me. It was more talking to him about the grief. And I could just really open up to him about how hard it was, how bad it was, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was just so there with me and in such a loving way. And so there was so much space to be free about that and to really be able to talk about it and also have him, you know, give some ideas of how to work with it. Or I don't even remember him doing that particularly. That was more just looking at me and, mm-hmm. you know, providing space and love, a sort of fabric of love, or a space of love that I could kind of relax into.
That's just what I said, Lama. When I first met him, he created an unconditional space. There was no Richard or even Ram Dass in the moment. And I could just relax and be at home in that moment. Mm. And that's, you know, that's funny. It's exactly the same feeling I had in that. And I've seen, you know, him do that with gazillions of people and be able to be here now instantly, which is quite a great quality. The best thing that I heard, though, oh, God, he had stick-on tilaks that he bought in India and was putting and giving to Bhagavan Das. That's unbelievable. Okay.
And
that's
they were mirror ones.
The mirror ones that
had like little lines in them. So it kind of created a rainbow thing.
Right. Oh, God.
They were cool. Mm.
You mentioned, this is what I'm going to tell you is a little bit embarrassing, but you're a good friend. So when you talked about the stamps of Maharaji that were going around at one point,
yeah.
right? So Rameshwar Das, who just his book with Ram Dass, Ram Dass's memoir, Being Ram Dass, is just out wow. last week.
Oh,
and I think one is on the way to you, by the way. So,
thank you.
Anyhow, because he's a photographer, he made all these great little stamps of Maharaji.
Oh, that was him.
That was him. Yeah. And he gave us all sheets of it. And then Maharaji would go, he found out, you know, anybody got any stamps? So we gave him the stamps. And then he'd like give all of them to the one Indian person that you thought was the last person that you get even one stamp, because he was a budmash of some sort. All right. So one day I was actually across the courtyard from him and he yelled out, anybody got any stamps? You know, and I had only a certain amount left. So I actually pulled them out and ripped them in half. I mean, took half of the quantity, put one half back in my Jola, and I went running up to give it to him. I gave him the other half. He took it. And he went, look, I had just stuck him with a knife or something. He took it and he threw it back at me and went, nay, you idiot. You're going to give me half.
Where's the rest?
Now we, of course, in this conversation, because I've been looking at the book that you know, Feeding the Demons, which is Lama's great book that can, one major, aside from just wanting to get back with you, you know, it's exactly what many of us need at this time. Anyhow, that was my little demon, right? So of greed,
of
holding, grasping. Yeah.
Yeah.
So about a week went by. I felt like I should, you know, I wanted to hang myself. I mean, just because you see all this horror that you're producing. And anyhow, I went back and I was sitting with him one day and he goes, anybody got any stamps? So I took this out. I gave him everything. He turned around. He turned the other way and he gave it to somebody. And then he looked back at me and he did the classic thing that you see in pictures. Watch out, MF. Right. We were little kids, you know, back then.
So you were able to give him those stamps when he was alive. Yeah. So I think he was still alive at that time in Canada. And then I heard about him passing.
Hmm.
It happened soon. Now, when was that exactly?
That's September 73.
Oh, 73.
Yeah, September 73. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, to get it, all this reminiscing, everybody, you give us a little bit of breath of spaciousness because we haven't seen each other in so long. So talking about feeding the demons, and as soon as you say the word demon, people, you know, I mean, we just. I just was talking to somebody not long ago today who was asking, in the memoir, Ram Dass talks about how he would have a picture of somebody who represents some very negative stuff in the political arena. And of course, lately it was Trump. And I said, so they thought that was delightful that he was doing that. I said, delightful. I went to him and went, are you really are putting Trump on the puja table next to these saints? And he said, yeah, it's just a shitty incarnation. I'm not relating with that. I'm relating to the behind all of that soul. And I said, well, more power to you, because I can't do that. And so, you know, talk about the level of extreme negativity. Well, this is your thing. You explain, what are we talking about with demons and the fact that we are all carrying around?
Well, you know, it's actually very commonly used word. I heard it around the time of the insurrection at the Capitol. I've heard it used, like I notice it because of the book.
Yeah.
That word is actually, then all the demons came out, or all their demons, or, you know, they died after, you know, their demon of alcohol got hold of them or something like that.
Yeah.
It's actually used colloquially quite a bit. But what I mean by demons is anything that blocks you from being completely free.
Yeah.
So in Sanskrit, it's called Mara. And so our demons are quite personal. In other words, when I say your demons, like you knew you had that demon of grasping, and we know what our demons are.
Yeah, we sure do. But so... It's okay, and we all have them.
Partners do. we may be blissfully unaware or consciously unaware.
Yeah, right. Well, in the book, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, So my point with the book was these things that are our demons, and that could be an addiction, it could be a fear, it could be a natural physical illness, but these are things that keep us from being completely present and free. And so in the story of the Buddha, you have Mara, who was a sort of personification of really the Buddha's own demons, the things that he was still held back by. And so the principle of feeding your demons came from an 11th century Tibetan woman teacher named Machik Lapran, which means one mother torch of Lap. Lap is a place in Tibet. And so her approach was feeding, not fighting. So these things, like, let's say you're grasping, you would find where you hold that in your body most strongly, and then notice what color it is, what shape, what's the texture of that grasping, what's the temperature of it. And then you move it out and personify it in front of you as a being, not a human being, but more like a
entity,
monster being,
yeah,
demon being. And then you feed it to complete satisfaction. And you feed it your own body. Your own body dissolves into nectar, and you feed it that nectar. And so this is a really different approach than we usually have with our demons, which is to be sort of embarrassed about them and try to repress them, get rid of them, put them in the closet, whatever. So in this method, you invite them out, meet them, and then you ask them what they want and what they need, and then how they will feel if they get what they need. And so the need is the deeper thing that's under that want, and then you feed it. So what happens sort of paradoxically, you think, well, feed the demon, doesn't it just get bigger and stronger? But it doesn't. It relaxes, and then that part of yourself integrates and becomes an ally.
So when he Maharaji threw the stamps back at me and went, he didn't say anything but nay. The week after, for the next week, my reaction was, where can I find a tree and a rope and hang myself, or where can I stick my head in that river?
That bad, really?
It was really, guilt and one demon after another just showed up, shall we say, right?
Shame, I bet, is a big one.
Now I look back and go, oh, human little guy, right? At this point, it seems amusing, but in reality, these things are happening to us on a day-to-day basis. And let me read something from the book, which struck me to even start this conversation. It's actually the end of the book. I think you were talking to one of your daughters just about what you wanted from the publication of the book and so on. And so you talked about how, and this is interesting because this book was written a number of years ago. I flashed on the world situation today where countries and religions demonize one another. Nature itself is becoming demonic in its ever-increasing numbers of hurricanes, floods, earthquakes, droughts, and tidal waves, and viruses. Right? I thought about how we are all tormented by polarization within and without. And I found myself saying, I feel we are in desperate need of a new paradigm that inspires us to stop fighting against ourselves and each other. I would love to like to see a world in which people no longer think that the best alternative is to destroy whatever opposes them. So what strikes me and what we should maybe highlight and hopefully bring out is what this new paradigm can be. What can we as individuals, I mean, we, thank God, went through a great day yesterday where someone who, I mean, this is my opinion, is very much possessed by some really tough, tough demonic spaces. And it was a real detriment, as we saw a couple of weeks ago at the Capitol. To any kind of unity. So yeah, what's the paradigm here that you believe some of the first things and some just plain down to earth stuff? Maybe people aren't particularly practicing Tibetan Buddhism or Bhakti Yoga or whatever our path may be. Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, you're saying we need new paradigms.
Yeah.
What are they and how can we implement them?
Well, the paradigm that I'm suggesting is feeding, not fighting, which is really what Maharaji said too, right?
Love everyone.
Feed everyone. Yeah. And probably feed your demons too. But so the polarization that we have now in the world, and we had then too, that book came out in 2008. That polarization is caused by thinking someone else is completely wrong and you're completely right. And one of the things that I liked, I remember at the time, was around when Obama was running. And he said, I would talk to the enemies. I would actually meet with the enemies. And that was just such a perfect answer. I think, you know, now we have this polarization with the white supremacists and the QAnon and that whole faction of our society. And so what are we going to do with them? I think there should be dialogue and just find out. I mean, when somebody's really too out there, you can't really have a dialogue. But I think that there are parts of that part of our society, of our country, that need to be listened to. And if they feel that there's a voice for them, then they can be integrated in a less violent way. And I felt this about terrorists too. When we, if we had tried to dialogue with some of those factions, find out what they need, what are they so upset about exactly? And just see, I mean, maybe you can't do anything, but at least rather than just repress them, lock them up, cut their heads off, you know, kill them, let's find out, because these are all part of us. It's all us. And everyone has Buddha nature. And this is something I see in Biden, that He does want that dialogue. He does want those people to feel included. And probably a lot of their anger comes with various kinds of frustration and feelings of exclusion. I'm not saying, you know, that we should indulge those people and there should be no results from what they do and did and so on. But my point is more that, you know, we have within ourselves these demons that we fight against, but actually the more we fight them, the stronger they get. They actually get energy from the fight. And then if you look at the collective situation in our country, we have these demons also. And if we just fight against them, they'll get stronger. Whereas if there can be a kind of rapprochement where, you know, there's some dialogue and, you know, even just hearing somebody listening, then there may be less need for violence. And our sort of collective psyche becomes more integrated. So if you think about it, like, let's say you're like a religious person, but you have like, say, like a sex demon, you know, and you keep trying to like get rid of it, repress it. And maybe, you remember, I always think about this, this is a long time ago now, but there was this minister in Colorado who was really anti-gay. And then it came out that he was actually gay and was meeting lovers in Denver and so on. And so this part of himself, he was trying to get rid of. So violently. And rather than like, I have these tendencies, let's meet that part of myself and integrate it. And so we really have a paradigm. It's in all our movies. It's just everywhere of this power over rather than power with in general. And internally, this paradigm of get rid of whatever part of myself I don't like or I'm embarrassed by. But it doesn't work. It gets stronger. So that's the whole principle of beating the demons.
Right. And everybody understands that. Everybody, I think, having any kind of awareness, and certainly anybody who's got any mindfulness practice whatsoever, the more that we do that, the stronger. Pushing away makes it enormous, absolutely enormous. And the one thing, though, that I wanted to bring up is I think it's really the polarization is very tough because of collective imprints that we have. We have a number of different ones of them. You know, the whole racial justice thing that's happened in this last 400 years, but in the last year, where a few of the privileged white people have woken up a little bit more than they might have been prior to George Floyd. And that's a collective imprint on people who came over as slaves and then were kept in that extreme isolation for all of this time. Then you have the privileged white people have a collective imprint. Privilege.
You could call it a collective demon.
Yeah, you could call it a collective demon, you know, on all sides. That's tough stuff. There's a couple of young guys that take care of Be Here Now Network that will be editing and writing show notes, JR and Corey, for this podcast. And they grew up in the South, and they grew up under very extreme conditions in terms of conditioning the way that many Southerners have been conditioned. Mm-hmm. And they had the good karma and grace to be able to see and be aware and move through it in a wonderful way and still acknowledge it. And still they have families who haven't necessarily moved through it in a graceful way. So there's so many different imprints that are oriented towards a group that makes it even more difficult on an individual basis to break through that.
I talk about collective demons in the book. like homophobia or racism. And we've done some work with that in, there's trainings that I do with Feeding Your Demons. And in the level three of that, we work with our collective demons. Like I remember one person worked with being an Irish immigrant. And another person with racism. And there was a person from South Africa who had, you know, grown up with apartheid. And so on. So the way that I suggested dealing with collective demons was to deal with them on an individual basis. And then if you're in a group, for example, let's say you're doing a retreat on racial justice and you work with your own demon of racism and or implicit bias, unconscious racism, then everybody works with their personal demon and then gets together and talks about what the demon was and what the ally was for them. Because in the demon work, that energy that's caught up in the demon, let's say racism, that's just energy. And when that is met and fed and transformed, it becomes liberated. And then you have that energy and that's the ally. So that's the way that I've suggested working with collective demons is on an individual basis, but then bringing those together in a group to see what you saw on your personal basis.
Right. There was something that came up. Of course, so many people are going, well, how do I bridge this thing? How? I have the Buddhist metta practice, loving kindness practice, but to actually send, may you be happy. You know, if somebody was in part of the event at the Capitol, I mean, many different instances. So we found this thing with Ram Dass and Joseph Goldstein, actually, that was just wonderful. He was reading a letter saying, Ram Dass was, what do I do? And that was exactly the circumstance. I can't feel forgiving. I can't to the other party. Mm-hmm. And then Joseph said, interesting. Around 9/11, I was doing retreats, and people were coming and saying the exact same thing. We're doing metta practice. I cannot send thoughts of may you be happy to these people who cause this destruction. So he went away with it, and he thought, yeah, I mean, it's reasonable, right? This is totally, totally reasonable. So he said, but, you know, one thing we can do is may all beings have hatred dissipate from their hearts. And that was a little tiny footstep forward. Most people would go, yes, I can do that. So anyhow, I think that's those little steps are just like you're talking about individually. You must get with those demons inside yourself and then be able to start working on
collective.
Yeah, the collective, you know, and the collective imprint is a strong demon in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's really the principle that we all learned going to the East was begin with yourself. I know, you know, my parents wanted me when I went to India to do something like the Peace Corps or go do some sort of outer thing to save these poor people. And I always felt, but until you have really cleared your own motivation and done your own inner work, are you really going to be helping them? Or are you maybe going to be creating more chaos or more suffering or whatever? Yeah. I think a lot of times parents do that with their kids too. And I felt that with my parents sometimes with, you know, I'm doing this for your own good.
I love that. Yeah.
But that I really felt like, well, maybe you need to look into that yourself, you know, like, is this really for my good? Is this for your good?
Yeah, right. You know, this is a big question, and we all need to carry that along day to day. Yeah. And this is also Ram Dass. This is one of his central teachings was around social action, which he did a ton of. You got to work on clearing your own heart if you have any chance of being effective in any kind of social action. Doesn't mean you need to be perfect before you do that. It just means let us be doing that as we do the social action. And that's extremely important for sure. You know, we don't have much time left, but so this is for me. Not that it's all for me, but I've been reading this book. I don't know if you know, it's a book on Tara. It's by somebody I don't know, Rachel Wooten.
I know her.
You do know her. And it's called The Liberating Power of the Female Buddha. I guess one of the things I either read or I knew that there was a strong connectivity between the Tibetan deity Tara and the Hindu deity Saraswati. And so it led me to, all the different aspects of Tara are just incredible. The one great white soothing Tara, she helps release the dark emotions that arise from painful experiences. Mm-hmm. She enables you to generate kindness towards yourself. Is there a way to integrate this kind of a teaching without being, because of Neem Karoli Baba, many of us who come from this tradition of, which is bhakti yoga, basically, have taken Buddhist teachings, have been with Buddhist masters, and this is the integration of the two is probably the most important thing that is offered through this tradition that he said it's beyond any tradition, because he was sending he got me with Kalu Rinpoche, right? Back in the day, he didn't do anything. Actually, it was all happening, but he was narrating it before it happened. Kind of is what he was doing. So, but I'm not a major practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism. One of my favorite teachers is Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, and you and I have talked about him before. But this intrigued me as a student or as a someone who takes whatever comes in front of me, and I don't care where it comes from. If it's teaching that's going to be useful, God bless. And so do I need to be a more of a practitioner in order to take the teachings of great white soothing Tara? How can I take that and integrate it into my life without the kind of, and I know how deep you go with your students at the retreats that you have, that you've done at Tara Mandala and so on. And yet here it is. I think this can be, is there a way to get this to somebody that's not necessarily deep inside of Tibetan Buddhist practice?
One of the things about Tara is that she is accessible without having to necessarily receive the empowerment and the whole traditional transmission and so on. She's like Madonna in the Christian church, you know.
She's like who? I didn't hear you. So
like the Madonna.
Oh, Madonna. Yeah.
I say Madonna because I lived in Italy for 7 years, but people have a very different relationship with the Madonna than they do with Christ or God. And she's there for you in a way that a mother is, you know. It's not sort of this, you know, exalted, distant presence. It's a very personal, compassionate presence. And so you could do the mantra of that tarn and the visualization and work with that energy without necessarily having to do a whole thing. Mm. And one of my lineage holders, his name is Lopan Chandra Easton. So it'd be an interesting person for you to interview, because she is doing research on the 21 Taras and teaches those mantras too. And she has a beautiful singing voice.
Oh.
She knows Sanskrit also. And so there's 21 and there is a climate change Tara, literally. There is a Tara to balance the seasons and the rains. There's also a Tara connected to weapons of mass destruction. And Saraswati is one of the Taras. She's the second of the 21 Taras. So there's 21 and there's one for epidemics like this. Wow. Yes, the 20th Tara. And so she teaches an online course really going into depth with each of those 21 Taras and also has chosen women, historical women, who she feels sort of correspond with these different Taras. And so she's writing a book now about this and teaches this online. Hmm. But in any case, your question is, I really like her, but I'm not exactly, a kosher Buddhist, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a kosher a kosher Hindu either, or Jew.
Can I have a relationship with her if I'm not? And the answer with Tara is yes. There's some deities where really you need to have the wong and the long and the tree and the whole traditional process.
Yeah.
But Tara's in a different category. And so we do things through Tara Mandala around where we will do an online, I guess you'd call it a campaign, around different events, you know, like with the drought in California and the fires. We did the 12th Tara, which is the climate change Tara, and you visualize her over the whole state of California, pouring down rain, the gentle rain, and so on. So we've opened these up online through my Facebook page and Tara Mandala Facebook page so that people, we give them the mantra, tell them the visualization, and then they count the mantras and sort of write them in. And then we have goals. We have a campaign going on now that was around the election, the Tara connected with justice. Hmm. And so anyway, basically that's a long answer. Yes, you can.
How about this right now? Can you, first of all, tell us what the mantra is for White Tara? And can you just do a few rounds of it so that we have that before we end here?
Are you prepared to do that right now?
Oh, it's complex.
I don't do White Tara myself a lot. Uh-huh. I would have to prepare for that.
Okay, how about the basic one that many of us do know?
Great. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
That would be great.
I'll lead everyone in a little meditation on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so everybody get comfortable. Take a comfortable seat, which, by the way, is the first thing that the Buddha always said about how to practice, take a comfortable seat. So that's not necessarily cross-legged on the floor for Westerners. Anyway, take a comfortable seat and close your eyes. Take a moment and just become present in your body. And then we'll begin by sounding the seed syllable of all of the Taras, which is Tam, spelled T-A-M. And as we sound this seed syllable Tam, imagine yourself becoming Green Tara. And that would mean that you have your right leg in a stepping down posture, your left leg tucked in a cross-legged posture. Stepping down posture represents for coming into the world to be a benefit, and the tucked in posture of her in meditation. So she's simultaneously both. And then in your left hand, you're holding an Utpala flower that's blue. It's a very rare flower with 1,000 petals, lotus flower, and it's blue. Your body is green. And then your right hand is extended. I'll put my hand out into the screen so people can see, but it's extended like that, or just stretched out on your right knee. And that's the giving posture, the giving of blessings and healing. So we'll sound the Tam together and then become luminous Green Tara. Your body is made of light. You don't have a liver, intestines, and so on. You're just light, green light, like an emerald. And now we'll do the mantra. And as we do this mantra, imagine that green light is coming out of your body and it's going to heal whatever needs to be healed, to take away fear wherever fear is present, to offer love and compassion wherever it's needed as a green light. And it's going out to all beings everywhere. And we'll sing a little bit of the Green Tara mantra. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Swaha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare
Ture swaha om tare tu tare ture swaha.
And then gradually dissolve your luminous green body into a tiny sphere of green light. And then that sphere itself also dissolves. And you rest in open awareness. And then we'll dedicate any merit or positive energy that we've gained to doing this little practice together to benefit all beings everywhere. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This reminds me of for those of you, actually, because I am reminded because of the spaceship I just went on inside, that a number of a few years ago, we did a podcast with Lama. Is actually with my old partner, David Silver. And I don't know if you recall this, but you did a lengthy Feeding the Demons meditation that was, yeah. I thought it was quite exceptional. I mean, you've done a billion of them, but in them was all my
yeah,
first
that was
moment.
Most of our time together was taking people through that whole process.
Yeah. So you guys, you can find that mind rolling. Just bring up Lama Tsultra Malioni, and it's the first. We've done several, but the first one has that meditation. I think we might have even cut it out and offering it somewhere else. But basically, you can listen because it was a great podcast as well. And I thank you for being here now with me, Lama. It's been great as usual. And I know you're just down the road these days, so when this particular demon decides it's had enough of us, we shall get together.
I've actually had my first shot.
Oh, really? Oh, fantastic. Not available here. Just becoming, actually, right now.
Yeah.
For elderly people.
It was like a fluke. Like the Dakinis just sort of got in there. It was like it was 5-minute window, and somebody sent me a link and I got in.
Really?
But yes, I would love to see you.
We will, because we have this wonderful HQ for Love Server Member Foundation, and the idea was to do small weekend workshops and have you come and others of our family and share time and space with us. So,
how are you doing?
Good. Good. I mean, we're hanging in there, you know. It's like everybody. We've all been dealing with some tough stuff over this last year. And I've said this a billion times on my podcast because I found this many months ago from somebody who said, here's a great aphorism that the ancient Chinese used to use for times like this. Dangerous opportunity. Is that great, right? Mm-hmm. So we are all making our way through in a way that is an opportunity, and yet it's fraught with all sorts of tough stuff. So
you're in Ojai, right?
Yep. Yeah. So I'm going to close this out. Mm-hmm. And everyone, thank you for joining us and joining Lama and myself. Of course, everything in the show notes will lead you to find the meditation and find Lama Tsultrum's book, Feeding the Demons, and connectivity to Tara Mandala. And this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and you can share stuff with all of Lama Tsultrum and my friends. Many of them are up on the podcast network. We got to get you to do a podcast or two, actually. If we can twist your arm, talk to some your friends as well. And we'll see you next week again. Thank you. And Ram Ram.